going to get to that later.
That's comedy gold right there, my friend.
Okay.
All right. Welcome to the Life of Caesar VIP show, boys and girls. Ray and I have just been having some tech trouble and laughing. I'm about to call loop in a guest speaker, Alexander Mikrobitsi. He is a history professor in Louisiana, Shreveport. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it because I'm an Aussie.
Shreveport.
Shreveport, okay.
Hello.
Hello, Alex.
Hello.
Hello, hello. How are you, Cameron?
I'm very good, mate. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. And hi, Ray.
Hello, how are you doing?
Excellent.
Now, Alex, I was just sort of doing a bit of an introduction when we hooked you in, but why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners? That's probably a better way of doing it. I couldn't even pronounce Shreveport correctly, so I'll probably screw everything else up.
Yeah. Well, I'm an associate professor at Louisiana State University in Shreveport, specialize in European and Middle Eastern history, as you know, but I'm originally from country of Georgia. Some of the things that we'll probably discuss about Mithridates have a direct impact on my own neck of the woods.
Now, because it behooves me, it is tradition on this show, Alex, that I have to insult all Americans as often and as early as possible in the show.
Just go and get it out of the way.
I just want to point out that Georgia is not the state of the U.S.
No.
Because I know that when Vladimir Putin invaded Georgia, a lot of Americans thought he was invading the United States. Do you want to explain a bit about Georgia for the audience?
Well, I think those who are listening to you probably know the difference.
Probably, yeah. But I insult them anyway because I think the ones that are still listening kind of like it. It's a bit like battered wife syndrome. They're like, yeah, abuse me, Cameron, abuse me.
So yes, that's right. So even though I have an accent, and I think quite distinct one, that's the southern accent.
Just because you sound like a villain in a James Bond film from the 60s.
Yeah, in a good way.
I on the first day of lectures, I tell my students to call me Dr. M, which makes me sound like Dr. No. So, end of the course, they might actually consider me the villain.
That's great, man. So, I know some background for the audience. I was chatting to Alex on Facebook a few weeks ago and invited him onto the show, because he'd done quite a few Napoleon shows with Markham and I back in the days before David went crazy and started abusing me on Facebook. That's all right. He doesn't listen to the show.
No,
he might listen to this one. Oh, well, there you go.
That's right.
I'm only kidding, David, if you're listening to this. I love you.
I'm going to send him a link.
Yeah, you do that.
Yeah.
And I invited Alex on, and he said, well, you know, I can talk about Mithridates. Now, I was saying to Ray before we started, I mean, apart from the stuff that we've covered when we were sort of talking briefly about the outcome of the Mithridatic Wars, I didn't know a lot about Mithridates. He's not a guy that I've read a lot about, although I remember when we were doing that episode or two on the Caesar show, I said to Ray, wow, this guy deserves an episode, like a series of his own. The bit that I did read was amazing. So I went and got The Poison King, which seems to be the book to read by Adrienne Meyer. And I haven't finished it, but I've read sort of the first third of it and the end. I sort of just skipped all the middle bit. But it's because I had to read it last night in prep, Ray. Yeah. Come on, I couldn't read the whole book. But it's such a great story. And I guess one of the things that I wanted to start off with, Alex, is according to her book, I assume it's a her, Adrienne, or is it like a French way of saying Adrienne? Anyone know? Is the author of this book a female?
Yes, she is, yes.
Oh, good. Is that even though a lot of people in the West may not have heard of Mithridates or may not know a lot about Mithridates, in sort of the Middle East and in places like Georgia, Turkey, where his empire was,
Crimea.
He is actually very, very famous. Is that correct?
Yes, true. I wouldn't say maybe very, very famous, but maybe with one very.
Okay. I mean, is he the equivalent of Caesar in the West?
I think in some respect, because I certainly can speak about him in that context. I remember being a child and reading over, you know, children's history books, Georgian history books, and Mithridates being portrayed as a hero who was challenging these dastardly Romans. And because for Georgia, this is the turning point. The Romans reached Georgia. That is a direct result of Mithridatic wars, because Colchians, Iberians, as the proto-Georgians, they actually supported Mithridates to the end, and so that resulted in the invasion of Georgia by the Romans. So I remember being excited about reading his life, and he's certainly a remarkable character that for a child, certainly the imagination, right, can run wild.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things for me, for example, what I related to and the stuff that I know many of the Georgians relate to is the fact that he lived in the region that is right next to Georgia, that's to start geographically. In fact, a significant part of the population that he governed was of Georgian descent, whether we talk about in Colchis, where my family is from, or from the regions around the Trapezunt, where there were quite a few tribes that are oftentimes described as of Georgian ancestry. So and those are the tribes that, for those of your listeners who are interested in looking and in reading, for example, Xenophon. Xenophon has a great description of these tribes in his Anabasis. That where he describes how warlike and savage some of these tribes are, and many of them served Mithridates throughout the Mithridatic wars.
Right.
Right.
Oh, do you have headphones, Alex? I've got some echo coming through your line.
Hold on a second. Yes, I do, and I'll connect them right a second.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that
better? Yeah, I think so, although you dropped out a second there. Just say a few words.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay. That's much better.
Okay.
So Alex, if I could you, and I don't want to ruin the timeline, Cam, if you had something else, but could you give us an idea of maybe some of his earlier years, or how he comes to power, supposedly, after his father dies and all the...
Yeah. Well... Absolutely. His family is, as most of the ruling families in what is Anatolia, were of mixed background. We know that Mithridates claimed a dual ancestry, and most contemporaries, whether his enemies or his supporters, agreed with his claim. So whether this is a propaganda, intentional propaganda or not, the contemporaries certainly believed it. And the ancestry that Mithridates claimed came from both Greek side and the Persian side. And on the Persian side, Mithridates claimed to have descended all the way from Cyrus the Great, the Cyrus Vazaka, and Darius. And and we know that the great kings of Persia certainly had the large families, plenty of wives and concubines, that to make this claim plausible. And on the Greek side, Mithridates oftentimes claimed to have had the connection to Alexander the Great. It's difficult to see the direct connection, although we know that his mother, Laodice, was related to one of the generals of Alexander, Seleucus. We know that the mistress, one of Alexander the Great's mistresses, was very close to Mithridates' ancestors. We know that one of Ptolemy's, the great Ptolemy who stole Alexander's body, right? His descendant, a woman by the name of Cleopatra. We know that she had a connection with the Mithridates family, and ultimately one of the this valuable, rather precious artifacts, the supposed cloak of Alexander was ended up actually in the hands of Mithridates because of Cleopatra sent it off for safekeeping, which gave Mithridates this in some sense legitimacy, right? He has a direct possession of something that Alexander had. But what is interesting about this court that his father, unfortunately for us, these guys like the names Mithridates, Laodice too much. So, right, the Mithridates that we talk about is the number six.
Right.
But his father, right, number five, has a rather interesting court, a melting pot of some sorts where Greek culture is combining with the Persian, Iranian, local, Aboriginal influences. We know that his father certainly worshipped, at least performed some of the Greek rituals. But at the same time, he was also the magus, the chief priest of Persian Zoroastrian religion. So when we consider the cosmopolitan nature of Pontus, right, this kingdom where, and then the capital of Pontus, Sinope, where Mithridates grew up, it's easy to understand some of the claims that are made about Mithridates, for example, his cosmopolitan outlook on the world, his polyglot nature. We know that he spoke more than a dozen languages. But probably in a society where you do have in a cosmopolitan society like that of Pontus, probably it would have been easy to learn these languages. But you're right that his father died, right? I think he died around 120, right? He died around 120.
Mm-hmm.
He was poisoned, right?
Yeah, which brings the very interesting dimension, right, to Mithridates. He's notorious for being this great tester of poisons, and so oftentimes he's credited with being the first practical practitioner of this art of poison. I don't know how legit that claim is, but certainly he's notorious for it. But on the other hand, I can understand why, right? Here you have your father dead, clearly poisoned by your mother. You know that quite a few rulers in the neighboring states had a nasty tendency of indigestion of the dinners. I wouldn't be surprised for this boy to be interested in poisons, trying to understand the powerful substances, especially because these plants or minerals or whatever substances were used for the poisons were quite available in that part of the of Anatolia. We know that the Eastern Anatolia, the Black Sea region, was notorious for the arts of poisons. To start, at least from the Greek perspective, just think about the famous myth of Argonauts and Medea, right? Medea being this symbol of dark magic. As she helped Argonauts on their quest. What fascinates me is that, so here you have the Mithridates Senior, right, the number five guy, dying after a dinner. So when his will is revealed, it is clear that although he had seven children with his queen Laodice, he left the kingdom to his eldest son, our Mithridates, but as a co-ruler with his younger brother, also called Mithridates. To distinguish, Mithridates, our guy Mithridates is Eupator, as he will become known, the good father, while his brother was simply Mithridates the good. And because both children are of relatively young age, their mother Laodice is a regent. But as we look at the sources that we have on Mithridates, we realize that Laodice certainly favored her younger son more than the older one. So at least Mithridates claimed that there was clear favoritism going on, and so he became concerned that that something might happen to him. Something, right? And so one day, he and his companions told the mother and whoever the advisors were that they were going on a hunting trip. So they left and never returned, which is quite a way to disappear.
Right.
There is a debate on how long he is gone, but probably at least 5, maybe 7 years that he's gone, starting around 120 until maybe around 115.
And so what age is he when he disappears? About 16, something like that?
Yeah, about 15, 16. If we count, let's say, 120 as the him coming out, right, the crowning, and then maybe a year from then.
Mm.
Actually, that date, that's good that you brought up that date, because if your listeners can Google Mithridates coins, and one of the things that you will come up with will be probably the classical coin of Mithridates in the profile, which is very striking, has a striking similarity to Alexander the Great's coin. But another one will be the coin with the comet, and that is particularly interesting because in the West, starting with Roman times, if not before, comets are bad things, right? That's especially true in medieval period, right?
Bad omens.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Christian Europe was in fear of comets. But for Mithridates, comets were a good thing. You know? But that same can be said about East as a whole. Certainly, comets were not considered bad omens, more of a omens of something good to come. And what is fascinating is, we know that there is a special phenomenon called Mithridates Comet. That is a comet that was observed in the skies when he was born around 135. We know of that comet from several sources, not just Roman and Greek, but also Chinese, who actually speak about this rather bright star. And then we know that this either the same comet or a new comet appeared in 120. When Mithridates was crowned as a king. And so that theme of a comet is a very important one throughout Mithridates' life, and he effectively uses that as his symbol. Even on the coins where his profile is pictured, if you turn it around on the reverse side, there's always, in most cases, there are several symbols, and two of them tend to be a symbol of a star, like a comet, and the flying horse Pegasus. And one of the reasons, probably the reason for that is that the first comet that the foretold his birth was observed in the constellation of Pegasus. So for Mithridates, that was an important, more important claim to legitimacy, as if, right, the gods favored him.
Right.
And, I mean, there's some interesting connections between all of that stuff you've just mentioned, Alex. Mithridates, I believe, means sent by Mithra being the Persian and then I think Roman sun god. It was kind of a common god throughout that part of the ancient world, the sun god.
That's right.
And then when you start thinking about the star that appeared to the wise men who were Persian magi, I guess, with the Jesus stories, the comet that appeared when Mithridates was born. And then, he's supposedly sent by God, which is what Mithridates means.
Uh-huh.
And then his younger brother you mentioned before, Mithridates the Good, or Mithridates Crestus.
That's right.
And the connection between Crestus and Suetonius talks about Crestus for Christ and the Christians. There's a there's a lot of interesting overlaps when you read the Mithridates stories and the Jesus stories, which is kind of fascinating. And I know that there's a lot of documentaries and a lot of websites out there that try and say that one was inspired by the other. I don't know about how true that is, but there are definitely some fascinating overlaps and connections between his story. And one of the interesting things in Adrienne Mayer's book, she talks about the mythic hero script, and
exactly.
Anyone that's read any Joseph Campbell, I'm a bit of a Campbell fan all my life, will already know a lot of this sort of stuff. But she talks a lot about how Mithridates' life and story scores very highly on the hero script index.
Exactly. I think perfect score, right?
Yeah, perfect score, yeah.
So, That's right.
You know, so his mother is a princess, his father is a king, his parents are related. Unusual circumstances before birth, being the comet, reputed to be the son of or sent by gods.
That's right.
There are attempts to kill the hero during his childhood, abandonment, exile, separation. He also supposedly survived a lightning strike as a baby when he
At least twice, actually. Yeah, that's right. Once as a baby, which left that Harry Potter-like scar on his head.
Yeah.
and then they
ripped that story off from J.K. Rowling, right?
That's right. Well, according to Myers, Harry Potter, I think, scores number 14 points on that scale of heroes.
He grows up in a faraway land. Little is known of his childhood. Upon reaching adulthood, he returns to the kingdom after, 7 years in exile. Victory over powerful enemies, acknowledged as a king. He was called King of Kings. So all of these stuff. So I guess one question is, how much do we know of Mithridates that we can say is historically verifiable versus mythology?
I think there is a significant part of it that can be verified, and that can be done in two ways. One, from the written sources that we have, let's say. Of course, they have to be dealt very carefully, but still, we can glean most facts about his life, especially later half of his life, from those sources. Of course, the early part of his life, when he's just a prince, those conjectures. And I think one of the things that I'm divided about in terms of Myers' book is that her book has plenty of conjecture about the early part of his life, what he would have been doing or what he was thinking.
So you're right, Cameron,
that for early part of his life, that's an issue. But for the later part, we also have archaeological evidence, both in terms of numismatic finding, but also monuments, ruins that are directly related to him. So we can trace him.
We know he's an historical figure. We have Cicero's writings where he talks about the Mithridatic Wars, etc. I'm not disputing that he's mythological. But yeah. And most of what we know about him, don't we get from the Romans, his mortal enemies?
Yes, we do. I'm not arguing that you're questioning his historicity, but what I'm saying is that we can find, for example, inscriptions or monuments that support some of his actions or some of the actions that are described in the Roman sources. Because even Romans, right, his mortal enemies, grudgingly acknowledging some of the accomplishments that Romans that Mithridates have done. I mean, Justin, right, Justine, who is one of the big sources, key sources for us on Mithridates. He actually provides a whole speech that Mithridates gave in 89, right at the start of the battle, at the start of the war against Rome, and that speech is remarkable because it showcases how well versed Mithridates was in politics, how well informed he is about things that is happening in Germany, things that is happening in North Africa. So it showcases his skill in soliciting this information, in analyzing it, in developing a strategy. So even those Roman sources are quite useful, despite clear prejudice against him.
And Justin's account was supposedly based on a history written by a guy called Pompeius Trogus, who was an eyewitness.
That's right, and which is actually available online. So for those of us who are interested in reading the actual account, they can go to forumromanum.org and search Justin, and there is an entire book by him. That speech is particularly fascinating, and I hope we'll be able to talk about it later on.
So I guess that there were in days gone by a lot of contemporary and, in fact, even eyewitness writings about Mithridates, who he did, what he did, which unfortunately have been lost, but we have like Justin's account of those histories, etc.
That's right, because in the particular case of his speech, for example, Justin says that he considered this speech so important that he actually tried to find a full copy of this speech and tried to reproduce it in his work. So even though he actually produces an abridged version of Trogus's history, when it comes to that particular speech, he actually decides to include most of it, or at least what he describes as all the full account. Now, certainly there are problems with it. There are some embellishments in probably later day editions. But right. You're right. These guys are relying on some of the sources that are lost.
Yeah. So Mithridates... I think you were telling sort of his early life. His mother favors his younger brother, and so he, when he's about 16, he disappears.
That's right. So he's gone. So what about his mother? Well, her mother, that's an issue, I think, with some of these accounts that we have, is that her mother tends to be portrayed rather in one dimension. She's lascivious. She indulges to life of luxury and sex. We know that.
You say that's a bad thing?
No, the way.
It's good to be the queen.
No, the way she's portrayed, absolutely, yeah. Because what we see is that I think some of the contemporary sources argue that because she liked so much luxury, she became a rather compliant client of Rome. That she took money from Rome, and by taking that, and then heavily taxed her population, and because of that, she effectively became indebted to the Romans, who exercised considerable influence over her. So, in that sense, yes, it might be a bad thing. So, what about Mithridates? Those 5 or 7 years that he's gone are quite fascinating because we essentially know nothing of what he would have done. We know that he was moving from one place to another out of concern for his safety, and he probably would have crisscrossed the local area. He certainly would have gone to the city of Amasia, and for those of our listeners who want to learn more about this region, they can go to Strabo, the great geographer, who was actually related to one of the, one of Mithridates' generals, and he was born in Amasia, and he left very good descriptions of local areas, of what people lived, and he certainly is not far, in terms of time, he's not far removed from Mithridates, so his descriptions would be relevant to us.
Cool.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you can certainly pick up your story, but when he comes back, do we know, is there a battle? Is he able to sneak his way in? Is he able to maybe just politically maneuver himself into power, or does he have to threaten his mother?
That's a good question, because Justin effectively tells us that it was a bloodless coup, that he returned unexpectedly and seized and seized power. Now, Myers has a rather interesting scenario where she imagines Laodice entertaining guests at her estate, at a newly established, actually, city that she called Laodicea, quite the capital. So, and that she was probably staying there, not particularly concerned, and that Mithridates unexpectedly returned and claimed power. And certainly, that probably it's probably a feasible scenario, because there is no evidence that we have as of now of a prolonged conflict or actually a battle that Mithridates won. Now, Mithridates' travels during those 7 years would have taken him all across the region. And there are a couple of things to bear in mind when we think about this. One is that this is a period when he gets acquainted with the entire region, neighboring Pontus, around it, and he probably goes to Colchis, to Armenia maybe, and he visits people, he sees how they live, what they breathe and dream and whatever they do. We know that this is a time when he actively experimented with antidotes and traveling from different places. He probably was exposed to different practices that he later incorporated. We know that he probably forged connections during this time, right? I cannot imagine him going anywhere, you know, to a village and not establishing a connection that he would probably 5, 6, 10 years later will rely on. So this is a very important period for his life and for what he would accomplish later on.
And if I'm correct, it was during that time when he was away that he came up with the idea for the bat suit that he later on integrated to fight his enemies.
That's
Or am I getting my mythologies mixed up here?
That's exactly right. Right.
His father was killed. He went off to toughen up.
And... slightly different person. but same ritual, same ritual.
And and probably the cape is the same, yeah.
oh, yeah. Speaking of
actually,
which...
actually, the photos you see... there's a bust of Mithridates, and he's wearing a cowl, but it's like some sort of a tiger's head or something.
Yeah, what it is? A tiger?
Lions, yeah, lion's head.
There we go.
It's very Batman-esque.
It is. Yes, it's styled after Alexander.
This Mithridates, he ripped off Harry Potter, he ripped off Batman... Wow, he ripped off Jesus. Man, he was what a thief.
That's right. So he comes back. Yeah, go ahead.
He comes back, and there's a bloodless clue, and he throws his mother and brother in prison, apparently.
Well, I wouldn't call it in a prison, but more of a in-house, puts them under house arrest, and then invites them to a dinner, and after dinner they have indigestion, and they die.
Oh.
So it's actually a rather short story when it comes to his mother. She actually is dead shortly after he comes to power. He organizes this public funeral for her and so on and so on. And then, of course, he decides to marry. And quite remarkably, he looks around and decides to marry his own sister. And guess what her name is?
Laodice.
There.
They only had two names they could remember. I mean, it's a lot easier if you only have two names. You don't have to think too hard. To preserve the purity of the bloodline, the whole Darius Alexander bloodline, he's got to have sex with his sister. I mean, come on, you come from Georgia, down south. Yeah. You know what it's like.
Yeah. Here it comes, Georgian.
Connection. Oh, I think Ray's just dropped out. Ray, that's weird.
Should we call? Should we wait for him?
Yeah, let me just loop him back in, man.
How is Fox?
He's great, thanks, mate. Yeah, although I'm tired as hell. I was up a few times last night.
I bet. Yeah, I wanted to ask you how you feel.
Yeah, he normally sleeps really well. Last night he got up a couple more times than usual. And Ray is not answering.
He got bored and left.
All right. Well, you can keep talking, and I'll hook him back in when he gets back online. He's probably got technical challenges. So he marries his sister, and then starts to sort of consolidate his rule. Is there anything you want to talk about before 88 BCE? Because I love the 88 BCE story.
Oh, yeah. Mention a couple of things. Once he becomes the king, as a full-fledged king, we see some of these eccentricities that he is showing, right, the peculiar behavior. So one will be his appearance. He certainly highlights his Eastern appearance with the... starting with long, curly hair, which Romans consistently found barbarian and Asiatic, right? As if that was a bad thing. We know that he was a great fan of gardening, and gardening of particular kind. He actually hired or brought to his palace a rather prominent botanist, Crataeus, who created the remarkable gardens in Sinope, where Mithridates grew different plants that could be useful for poison, for their poison properties. So he would actually bring in different flowers or plants from all across Anatolia and far beyond that. And we know that some of those plants actually were discovered actually for the first time as a result of his efforts, and therefore they bear his name.
Wow.
Which is quite interesting.
He was quite sort of the biologist slash proto-scientist, wasn't he?
At least that's the sense that we get, is that he's interested in tangibles. That's right. He's interested in experimenting. He's interested in seeing the properties of things. And in that sense, yes, you're right that he has a different outlook. Now, I don't think he's the only one. There is the Attalus of Pergamon, who is branded as a crazy, the mad king. But in reality, he shows the same behavior as Mithridates. He's just not, simply not as successful as Mithridates.
Right.
Therefore, he's mad, right?
Yeah. There's a fine line between eccentric and
crazy.
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah. Another interesting thing before we get to the 88 is his domestic policies. Is that once he becomes the king, he is actually quite successful in reviving the fortunes of Pontus. He initiates a rather intensive rebuilding program. He promotes free trade, which is an interesting concept in this period, and especially in this area, where he promotes connections both with the East and the West. We know that the farm of the first child. Chinese commercial contacts are established at this time through Iran.
Wow.
As we know, some of the first shipments of Chinese silk reach the Near East around 110-100 BC. So Mithridates certainly would have been exposed to that, and he would have been promoted that. We know that he maintained very close contacts with states, not just in Anatolia, but in Caucasus and in the North Black Sea region. And that we know that in this first 20 years of his reign, he is very careful in foreign policy. Now, he cultivates careful alliances. He's very cautious when it comes to Rome, and we see that right all leading all the way to 89. He's very, very patient and shrewd in his dealings with this great power. Now, on the other hand, he's also expansionist. Right, he's eager to expand his power as much as he could. So, for example, in 115, 114, he takes advantage of the problems that the Greek colonies have. That the Greek colonies have in Crimea, and so with the local Scythians and Sarmatians, so he actually invades the region, successfully conducts a campaign, and actually signs a peace treaty that establishes his protectorate in the region, and that protectorate will stay with him, will stay there until he's overthrown. In fact, many of his troops, if not most of his troops, were gathered in northern Black Sea. At least that's what Mithridates refers to.
I'd like to welcome Ray back to the show. Welcome back, Ray.
Thank
welcome
you.
Back.
Sorry, I just got so excited by the Batman talk. I think I hit the wrong key on my bat bell, and it just boom, it just went away. So I'm back now.
I thought that the mice that run in the wheel that keeps your internet going died, and you had to replace them with new mice.
Actually, you're closer than you realize. We're getting a bad storm here, and so, yeah.
Or the gods. Or some of the snakes ate the mice. And you had to kill the snakes.
So I have to do it. I have to power the wheel myself now and getting kind of tired.
Well, to give you, sorry, this is like completely random and off topic. Sorry, Alex, but we do this. Chrissy actually caught her first huntsman spider last night. It's sort of, I said she had to do it. It's part of actually becoming a real Australian. She may have done a citizenship ceremony, but until you've had to catch her. Until you've had to catch a hairy spider the size of your hand.
Oh, my God.
Then you're not a true Australian. Oh. And she did a bloody... Nice. She had to chase it around. They run fast. But she did it. I was very proud of her anyway.
Yay!
She didn't chop it into pieces like your wife does with snakes, though, Ray. We let it go outside, but yeah. Anywho.
That snake's not coming back. But anyway.
No. Sorry, Alex, for the random just... Bullshit.
No, but in some respect, it's relevant to a Poison King, right? Since we still talk. Are the huntsmen spiders poisonous?
No.
Oh, okay.
They're scary as hell, but they're not poisonous. They jump at you.
They are
poisonous, but not that it's not fatal to humans. If you're an insect or something smaller, it's probably not good. But but they're big and hairy and fast. You try and catch them, and I caught one about a month ago, and I actually killed it by accident because I had like a plastic container I was trying to catch it with, and it ran so fast I slammed the container down and sort of chopped it in half, kind of thing. And
there you go.
I seriously broke my heart. I mean, I cried.
I felt bad.
Really sad.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay.
Where were we?
We're talking about the first 20 years. We're sort of summarizing the first 20 years of his rule and his foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. So we talked about his intervention in Crimea, where he successfully both uses his power, military power, to project his authority, but also to mediate between the local Greek colonies and the local nomadic tribes of Scythians and Sarmatians, and establishes his effectively protectorate. Then we know that he comes back, and this is a fascinating thing that is not oftentimes mentioned, that around 110, he decides to do a grand tour of Anatolia. Now, the first time he disappeared, he most probably stayed in the close vicinity of Pontus. But this time, the second time, he again is traveling incognito. In fact, many of his members of the government don't even know that where he's gone. But he traveled actually to the west, visiting Galatia, Paphlagonia, Cappadocia, Bithynia, all of that in what is now West Turkey. And it is remarkable because he effectively scouts local areas for defenses, for trade opportunities, for resources, for roads, for people. And you don't see many times rulers of doing that, just going and just be gone. In fact, as I mentioned, he seems to have had a rather limited communication with back home, because after he was gone for more than a year, his own wife assumed that he was dead. So she actually assumed power and took on lovers, which proved to be quite bad when he returned unexpectedly.
For everybody, yes.
Wow.
So, Ray, you can probably guess what happened to Laodicea. She developed indigestion.
Indigestion.
Oh, my God. On a massive scale.
That's right. She actually was executed. Now, we know that Laodicea had a bastard son as a result of one of these affairs while Mithridates was gone. Interestingly, Mithridates, who, from all we know, executed Laodicea, he actually didn't kill the baby boy. His name is Ariates. Later on, I'll mention him because he's clearly recognized probably the utility of it, which is quite interesting. He effectively considers him as a bastard, or his own bastard son, even though he clearly had no relationship to him. And he will use him when he will deal with Cappadocian problems. After Crimea and after this grand tour of Anatolia, we know that around 104, Mithridates expands his state to Colchis, to western Georgia, secures that. We know that later on, once he secures this western Georgia, he establishes relationship with eastern Georgia, establishes good relationship with Armenia, and then he decides to flex his muscles. Now this time, so all of this is done, right? Whether we talk about Crimea, Georgia, Armenia, this is all in the east, so far away from Rome and Roman-controlled territories. So for the first time, around 103, 102, he decides to flex his muscles right along the border of Rome. So he conspires with the king of Bithynia, a fascinating guy. So by the name of Nicomedes. So maybe you should do another podcast on Nicomedes, Darren.
Well, this is Nicomedes the third.
That's right.
Not the fourth. We've talked about Nicomedes the fourth a bit on the show.
And I think the fourth one was a dumbass compared to his father.
Well, and he liked a bit of Caesar ass too, is of course the rumors.
The connection is X, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The queen of Bithynia. So, yeah, anyway, this is just for clarify, fellas. So, this is Nicomedes the IV's father.
Father, yes.
Yeah.
So, Nicomedes the III, Eugertes, as he's known. Nicomedes was a rather conniving weasel, a very capable guy by all accounts. So, Mithridates approached Nicomedes with an idea. Why not carve up Paphlagonia? It's right next border. It's lucrative. It's nice. So let's take it over. So Nicomedes says, sure, let's do it. The problem is Romans might have some problem with it. But Mithridates says, okay, let's go ahead and do it. So they actually went in and carved up Paphlagonia. Now, Romans did not appreciate that, so they actually wrote back asking Mithridates and Nicomedes to get the hell out of there. And here is the response that is quite different, you know, quite interesting. Mithridates initially says no, because he argues that Paphlagonia belonged to his ancestors, actually. He says, my grandfather ruled it, my father ruled it, and it is only after my death of my father when my mother ruled, right, that you took over Paphlagonia, so it belongs to me. But I like Nicomedes' response better. Nicomedes says, sure, you want it back? No problem. I'll restore Paphlagonia to its original ruler, a guy by the name of Pylaemenes. Now, we don't know what exactly happened to Pylaemenes. I think he might have been dealt with by then. But Nicomedes actually takes his son, changes his name to Pylaemenes, takes to Paphlagonia, declares him as the rightful king, so it's Pylaemenes, then sends a message to Rome saying, hey, Pylaemenes is back on power, are you okay with that? The Senate considers, you can imagine them probably reading the letter, okay, who the hell is this? I don't know, Pylaemenes of Paphlagonia. Okay, so is that the same guy? Probably, right? So they approve it, not realizing that's a fake Pylaemenes. And so, in effect, Nicomedes secured control of Paphlagonia through this trickery. Now, Mithridates did not appreciate that, that trick. So he decides to expand to Cappadocia, and there is a fascinating story about Cappadocia that it is great. Now, Cappadocia was ruled by a guy called Ariates, and Ariates or Ariates VI, and like Pontus, the kings of Cappadocia had a nasty habit of calling all of their kings Ariates. So this one is Ariates VI. Now, Ariates VI is married to a princess of Pontus, in fact, Mithridates' sister. You probably guess what her name is.
Starts with a C.
Laodice.
Laodice. Yeah. I'm sorry, I was thinking of Cleopatra.
Oh, bad. Yeah, okay.
So he's married to Laodice, and they had a son whose name is Ariates. So when Ariates died, this is the father, when father died, Mithridates decided to flex his muscle, move in, and take over his sister's territory. Now, what he's surprised when to hear that just as he's preparing to move in, that Nicomedes, our good friend Nicomedes, has already invaded Cappadocia, has captured Laodice, and guess what? Laodice agreed to marry him. So he's pissed off. So he decides to actually threaten Cappadocia nevertheless. Now, Laodice has a son, as I mentioned, his name is Ariates VII. So Ariates VII decides to fight Mithridates. They meet on the battlefield. Two sides are drawn. Mithridates actually asks, who is effectively his nephew, right? He's the son of his sister. He says, okay, let's meet in the middle of the field. Let's talk. Ariates, knowing that his uncle was quite a brute, right, was quite powerful, quite an imposing figure, he just decides to accept this meeting, but he wants to have him checked. And so the you can imagine, right, two armies lined up, then smaller groups of these leaders surrounded by their companions move into the center. Mm-hmm. Then Ariates sends his guards to check, effectively to, what do you call it, what do they do in
frisk.
The airports?
Frisk.
That's right.
Yes.
Frisk. Mithridates stands there, this imposing figure. This Cappadocian guard frisks him, starts probably from the top, right? Checks his hair, checks his shoulders, checks his arms all the way, goes down, and then is about to touch his private parts to check with if there is something there, when Mithridates cracks a joke, says, "Hey, watch out. You might find a weapon quite different." You can imagine him winking, right? "You might find a weapon quite different from what you are looking for." And so the guard cracks up. He doesn't check him fully. And so the Ariates meets with Mithridates. Mithridates talks to him and says, "Hey, can I have a private word with you without these companions, just as an uncle and nephew?" Ariates says, "Sure, let's go." So they go out. Mithridates suddenly puts his hand into his private parts, gets out a dagger, and cuts his throat.
Whoa!
It's an amazing.
Oh.
Amazing, huh?
Oh,
and right in front of all these troops.
Whoa.
That's how you settle disputes.
That's right.
Then, instead of pulling a sola.
Yeah.
Imagine this Ariates, right? This is Ariates number 7, lying there, right? Blood gushing down. Ariates supposedly bends down, takes over his crown, walks over to his son. Remember that son, that the bastard son that his wife had?
Yeah.
Ariates. Mm-hmm. Takes him out, puts the crown on him and says, "From now on, you will be Ariates the number 8.
Promoted.
Wow. That's
amazing.
Wow.
Dude. All right.
These guys knew how to do it. Wow.
That's crazy, man. So, I mean, this is like Game of Thrones can't touch this shit, man. I mean, as violent and crazy as Game of Thrones is, you know, you read these stories, you go, wow, this was the real. I mean, again, yeah, as far as we know that this is
right,
historically accurate, and we have no reason to believe, you know, the stories like that aren't, that's it's crazy.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
Again, you know, they obviously, Mithridates was ripping off George R. R. Martin when he did all this stuff.
Lawsuit.
Yeah. All right, well, can we get to 88, Alex? This is all good.
One more thing. Well, hold on.
Sure.
Because you have talked about Marius, right?
Yes.
So how can we skip on the path, on the moment when around 99, this good old 50-year, probably, 58, 59 years old Marius, right, driven from Rome, comes to Mithridates, sits down and talks to him. I mean, that's quite a meeting. At least we know most of it from Plutarch, from his life of Marius. And we know that they sat down, they talked. Marius spoke about his campaigns. You can imagine Mithridates asking questions about the war of Jugurtha, right? The Numidians, maybe the war against German tribes.
Right.
And then he asks Marius, "What the hell are you doing here?" And Marius says, "Well, I'm here just on a religious pilgrimage, right? Do some rituals here." But I imagine Mithridates saying, no, really, why you're here? Mithridates, Marius effectively hints whether Mithridates will be willing to support him in a possible action, against his opponents back in Rome, that he hoped to stir the rulers of Asia, including Mithridates, to make war upon Rome, which is quite a conversation to have.
Right.
Nothing comes out of it because Mithridates effectively says no, not at this time. But there is this fascinating passage in Plutarch that I like, where Marius warns Mithridates, and there is this, at least this is a quote that Plutarch gives us here, that Marius tells Mithridates, "O king, either strive to be stronger than Rome or do her bidding without a word." And I imagine Mithridates listening to thing and thinking, "What an arrogant son of a bitch!"
And he went for the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, eventually, you're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. Can we get to 88 now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he's been king for 20 odd years, and he's, you know, he sort of had a Nicomedes the third is gone. Nicomedes the fourth, Caesar's
friend
with benefits, sort of tight with the Romans.
Tight.
That's not that's not a euphemism. Well, it is a euphemism, like Ray saying he had to let out the cat the other day. That's a euphemism. And he and Mithridates have a falling out. And you know, Rome's kind of busy. They've got the social war going on. But at this stage, there are Roman, as I understand it, there are Roman citizens, Roman merchants spread across not only Mithridates' empire, but all of his allies' empires. There are just, you know, Romans have infiltrated all of this. They've got an understanding. They're setting up. They've got their little shops. They're trading. They're doing all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of Romans spread across the Mithridatic empire and an associated empire. And so he decides to teach Rome.
Cameron, yeah. Can I interrupt?
Yeah, please.
It's not an empire yet, right? Because Mithridates only controls Pontus, parts of his western Georgia and Crimea. But there, it's not a problem as of a Roman presence as much as it is in western Anatolia, in Paphlagonia, in Bithynia. That's where the greatest presence of Romans is, but Mithridates does not control it directly yet.
No, but he has allies that control it, right?
That's right. Huh?
Yeah. So, what do they decide to do, Alex? You tell the story.
Well, a couple of things on that topic is that in order to understand what happened in 88, we need to remember that Romans, oftentimes we talk about Romans as the champions of the civilization, right? They bring certain level of culture and so on and so on. But on the other hand, right, we admire traditional Roman culture, battle prowess, maybe virtue, but there's another side to the Romans, is that they were actually quite arrogant, insensitive, direct, and brutes, especially when dealing with the local population. Romans had a very stereotypical view of the East, right? As a barbarian, as low of lower development, inferior. They, for example, considered most of the Anatolian population as stupid and good material for slaves. We can talk about a variety of proverbs even that the Romans had, such as, for example, all Phrygians improve with beating. What is that?
Wow.
I think Cicero said at one stage, the Roman name is held in loathing and Roman tributes, tithes, and taxes are instruments of death.
Exactly. Wow. And we talk about Nicomedes, right? That's the Nicomedes the Third, who, when Marius asked him famously for troops to fight against Cimbri and Teutons in 104, he famously responds, and this is a quote, "All those eligible for military service in my kingdom have been robbed by the Roman tax farmers and sold into slavery." So when we talk about this Anatolian population, yes, Romans are present, but they are not admired. They are not liked, right, for sure.
Yeah, and Maya has a list of Rome. She says, the Italian settlers with their households and slaves wove themselves into the fabric of these Anatolian cities, achieving economic power and political position. By 88 BC, a large population of Roman merchants, moneylenders, tax collectors, slave traders, entrepreneurs, shopkeepers, and others lived among the Graeco-Asians as neighbors. Many of the new settlers had acquired their land from native people bankrupted by Roman taxation. The Romans spoke Latin or Italian dialects among themselves, but bargained in Greek in the marketplace. They bet on the cockfights, prayed in the temples, laughed and cried in the theatre, yet they did not blend in. Their clothing and customs were different. Everyone knew who the Romans were. As historian Susan Alcock points out, they knew where they lived and they displayed every sign of hating their guts.
Yep.
Wow.
That's quite a neighbour to have, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I can't think of, maybe this is just me, I can't think of a contemporary example of, you know, a superpower empire that treats the rest of the world fairly harshly and is hated. for their, you know, brutal oppression and arrogance around the world. It's unfortunate that I can't think of a contemporary example, but...
neither can I.
Yeah. Anywho.
So when Mithridates comes on, he's going to have a lot of, at the very least, local support.
That's right.
From so these people, yeah.
That he can tap that hostility, right, tensions. But there is also another element in that there is a event that takes place about 50 years prior, almost 50 years prior, and that is that's after the death of King Attalus of Pergamum. Mm-hmm. That kingdom is taken over by Rome. That's one of the crucial events in this period. The Rome is actually establishing foothold. But there is a response to the Roman takeover of this kingdom, and that is a rebellion by Attalus' stepbrother, a guy by the name of Aristonicus. So what Aristonicus does is he refuses to accept this agreement that his brother had done with Romans, and he raises a banner of rebellion. Rebellion itself might have been, right, we probably don't even remember it, but there is an important element to it, and that is Aristonicus called for social reforms, or social economic reforms. He established, in many respects, a utopia, at least for the contemporary standards. He actually built a city called City of the Sun, where he proclaimed all citizens to be free and equal, where he promised all slaves who would come to the state be freed, where he promised to cancel all debts, and fight evils and vices. Now, that rebellion was crushed, but what we'll see when 88 comes around and when Mithridates starts his war, one of the first things he does is introduce social reforms that echo Aristonicus reforms. And that's what makes him so influential, so appealing to many, that he will talk about social change.
And that's where we're going to leave this episode, folks. This was a two-hour conversation we had with Alex. You've just heard the first hour, and the second hour will be in Consul episode number 5. So look out for that in your feeds soon. On behalf of Ray and myself, thanks for listening. Have a great week.